session number 19990, Real 90.
Chief Technician Roper, Real 19. You're telling me about Miri.
Well, Miri is in the northern tip of Sarawak, adjacent to Brunei. And of course, that's where all the oil is, particularly in Brunei. And Shell, over on Labuan Island, they had a leave centre for their personnel. And I think it must have been strategically important during World War II, even Labuan. Anyway, this was the North Borneo end of the problem, and of course it had all started, all this business, in Brunei in 1962. And there were there was a squadron, 110 squadron, took over Tawau, Sandakan, and that area, which, I mean, we very seldom went to Labuan. It was only after, during my tour in Singapore, that I used to do quite a few of the detachments up to Penang,
to Butterworth. Mm.
But I got the opportunity of going to Borneo to help photograph all the landing strips for a pilot's strip directory, which is part of a pilot's en route documents when he's flying in Borneo. He has on his leg, on a pad, all the frequencies of any of the airports or landing strips, and a rough plan of what they look like, which direction they run, and what facilities regarding fuel or fire facilities, etc. And the idea was that the Joint Air Reconnaissance Intelligence Unit in Singapore, it's known as JARIC, and they were to reproduce a strip directory, and we had to go and check the strips out to make sure that they were, what facilities they had, because in the days when the RAF had been there during confrontation, we kept fuel and so on, but now of course it had all gone, and a lot of them had become overgrown. Others had been kept like billiard tables, they were beautiful. And so we had to go with this aircraft for about 3 weeks to land wherever possible and to film from the air the plan of the thing and make notes. And so I was chosen to go as the engineer, and there was a pilot and a navigator and a photographer, and I also assisted the photographer. And we were based at Labuan. We would go out daily with a plan in mind as to which airfields we were going to visit. When we got to the airfields, the pilot would indicate that the photographer, who was sitting in the back entrance with no door on my toolbox, holding out I think it's a Mark V handheld camera. It looks for all the world like an Aldous lamp. And he'd sit looking downwards, and I'd be on the intercom in the aircraft, ready to tap him on the shoulder every time he had to take a shot. And then, having flown over the airfield, the pilot would then make an approach, or we'd photo, if there was some feature, we'd photograph it from the side, and then they used to photograph through the windscreen on the approach with a handheld Nikon camera. And I would make notes as to how far we'd got on the film.
You were keeping the log.
Shot 23 is of plan view such and such. And then we'd return to Labuan each night, and the camp was by this time closing down. There were very few people left. It was just a caretaker staff waiting to go home. But we reactivated the dark room in the photo section, And myself and this photographer would go and develop the films at night, put them into the log and mark them. And occasionally we'd probably have to go back to get another shot because something was wrong. And we flew round, and it gave me a terrific sense, because I visited places I'd only ever heard about, and I saw more of Borneo in that 3 weeks than I'd seen in the year I'd spent out there previously.
You got the overall picture of the terrain.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm. And
you said that some of the airfields were well maintained. Why would that be? Would it be because they had some commercial value or something of that sort?
Well, no, I mean, the locals, when you live in the jungle and you haven't got a job other than to feed yourself, they don't, I mean, the religion tells them when they should go hunting. If they see a bird flying east to west, they don't go. And so on. And so the head man of the village, who you often met wearing a Rolex Oyster and becoming westernized, if you like, the people had nothing else to do. And of course, when we were there and we carved out these airstrips and put a windsock up, and we got the locals to keep the grass short, they just carried on doing it. And we were finding fuel that had been left there since confrontation and saying, it was totally useless for the purpose it had been put there. So we used to divide it and say, this one is for your outboard motor and this one is for your cooker. And they were delighted to receive all, but they are sort of honest people. They hadn't pinched any of it. And, I mean, there was fire extinguishers that had long been out of date and so on. And all these notes we made. In some instances, the Malays were still used it, and it was still...
still operational.
There was still a radio there. It still had an air traffic control. And so on, and all these things were noted. And of course, we used to do an approach, and the thing was that they might have taken some trees down to the left of the runway. So the escape lane, if you got yourself into trouble, was to the left. In the early days, you could have an airfield and it had 200-foot trees on either side, except there was one bigger one sticking up there, so the escape lane was on the left. Now this, you know, you'd had it anyway if you hit the trees, so it didn't make much odds, but these were the sort of comments we made. And somewhere I have one of these strip directories, which is quite interesting to read, you know. But the length of the runway, some runways were uphill, so you could only land one way. But you could certainly only take off one way, and that was downhill. Because if you had a full load, you'd never make it taking off the other way. Others had one approach was down a mountain side, and you used to pick up a bad tailwind as you approached down this mountain. You sort of dived down parallel to the mountain and then levelled out. You never sank onto the runway. It'd just keep you airborne because of the wind. So these were things that they had to note, and this is what we were involved with. But on that trip, we had a really serious problem with the aircraft.
What aircraft was it?
Well, a lot of the controls.
Yeah, but what sort of aircraft was it?
Twin Pioneer,
yes.
But a lot of the controls were actuated by hydraulic pressure.
Yes.
And unbeknown to us, somebody had taken one of the hydraulic tanks down that holds the fluid, and it has a vent pipe, and they'd forgotten to disconnect the vent pipe. And so when they tried to remove the tank, the pipe is cleated to the wall of the aircraft. They pulled on this cleat, and the pipe had been crushed to about half its diameter. And when they push the tank back up,
yes,
to disconnect the pipe, the bit they'd reduced in diameter went behind the cleat.
So it remained pinched.
Yes, it was pinched together, but it was covered by the clip that was holding it to the side.
So they didn't notice.
And they didn't notice. They then undid the pipe, which released the tank, put a new tank in, and everything in the garden was rosy. But when we started doing short takeoffs and landings, where you need all your brakes and all the slats and flaps, and we're giving the system maximum pressure, pipes were blowing. We were developing leaks all over the place. Every time we flew and did a short takeoff and landing using flaps and slats, there was hydraulic oil all over the place. And you had to search to find out where it had come from. Usually it was all over one side of the aircraft or all over one wing and so on. And of course, these pipes weren't readily available except from wreckage that was strewn all over Borneo of other twin Pioneers that had crashed for one reason or another. Civvy ones, because the Borneo Airways operated twin Pioneers, they'd lost two or three of them. We'd lost some during confrontation. So I was going round these wrecks, picking up pipes and fitting them to where ours had burst. But
cannibalisation, in effect.
We signalled back, and I checked this vent pipe by just blowing down it, and there was no resistance. You blew, so the vent pipe was clear to my thing. But once you get the pressure under there, of course, this pinching it. But we got ourselves stranded in some awful places, Brunei Airport being one of them. But we limped round, and eventually I was sent out a new tank. And when we came to change the tank, I found the fault, and so we were all right after that. But I could have well done without it, because I'm an engine fitter, not an airframe fitter, which was the trade it was involved.
Was it a good life living at Salitar? Was it a good place to be?
Oh, yes. In those days, any of the camps in Singapore were luxurious. They all had golf courses. They had so many clubs. If you had a hobby, the aeromodelling club, the photo club, the yacht club, the you name it, there was a club for it. There were swimming pools, palatial sort of messes and so on. And you had smooth KD. It was not the rough stuff that is issued. You had beautiful Dacron shirts and so on. And you felt that you were in the empire. And we used to get cheap beer, and this was why there were so many clubs. Every club had an allocation of so many gallons of Tiger per month and so on. And of course the wives out there, I mean, it was like being on holiday. Beautiful sunshine, armors to look after the children and babysit while you went out. There were cinemas and so on, and of course Traitor Island itself, where you could buy beautiful fabrics and the things that you couldn't afford for the home in England, you know. A lot of wise people that went out there, they were saving, but they were also able to buy furnishings and particularly linens and towels and that, so you could send them back by the bale, you know, and cameras and so on. And of course you could afford to go on holiday you could get to Australia fairly reasonably, or Thailand, you name it. Some of them used to fly back to the UK, but it was Treasure Island, and the climate was so beautiful. I mean, it was warm. Each afternoon at 4 o'clock it rained. Nice cooling rain. Cooled it down for a pleasant evening where you'd be out. Shirt sleeves were the order of the day. You know, you'd seldom needed a sweater or anything like that. If you wore a coat at all, it was a very light sort of dress jacket, and it was probably the best posting, your general posting in the world, Singapore.
Yes. Well, what about Changi? Because I think you moved to Changi, didn't you, from Salita?
Changi, where Salita had been operating light aircraft, they had the Twin Pioneers, they had at one time Andovers, helicopters, both Whirlwinds and Belvederes. Changi was the heavy goods transport station where you had Hastings, you had Beverleys operating into there, you had VC-10s all came into Changi. It was where the service flights arrived with passengers.
Air trooping.
Yes. And Shackleton's, of course. So it was for the heavy, the mainly four-engined aircraft operation. And Changi I prefer to Salita. Salita was sort of a countrified airfield, not very close to town. But Changi, it was more hilly. It was close to the sea. The China Beach Club was on one side of the airfield, which was an RAF club. Changi Creek, which was the transit hotel for people waiting to be flown out, was at the seaside, more or less. I mean, I lived next door to Changi Prison in a very nice bungalow at a place called Knightsbridge. No, I'm not sure whether Knightsbridge was Changi or whether it was Salita, but I had this beautiful bungalow. And I like the feel of Changi, and you could at the village. You had a village, well, as you did at Salita. You had Jalan Kayu at Salita, but Changi village was something to be believed. It was nice. There was open markets, beautiful food, and bars and things. You know, really, really good.
What sort of work were you doing at Changi? How did it differ from what you've been doing at Salita?
Well, from Salita was closing down, the squadron was disbanded, and so I had the option of going home early or staying to finish my tour, and I elected to stay and finish my tour. So I went off to Changi, and at first they ASF there, there were separate ASFs. There was one dealing with Hercules aircraft, and the other was dealing with the Shackletons, which were playing an important role. Although they were an old aeroplane, they were fitted with very sophisticated radar and so on.
These were reconnaissance aircraft, weren't they?
Well, they used to do patrols, and they were keeping an eye on people like
maritime,
Smith.
Yeah, maritime, wasn't it?
Long-range maritime patrols, Indian Ocean and so on.
Yes.
And of course, there were still quite a few trouble spots, and they were keeping an eye on who was supplying who in southern Rhodesia and places. And they used to go to the Malagasy Republic, which I think was keeping an eye on who was feeding Smith in Rhodesia. But you've got aircraft that would take you down to, you know, we're going down the Philippines, or we're going long-range stuff, Australia, or we're going to the Solomon Isles, Gilbert and Ellis Isles, and those who wanted could get little jobbies like this. And of course, it was all sun and sand and treasures. But I was posted, and they said that I was going on to the Hercules ASF.
Yes.
And I spent about two or three days there, and then they said, no, we desperately need you in the engine bay. And the engine bay was an old wooden hangar that had been built, I think, by the Japanese. And it housed all the engines, propellers, and sparking plugs, etc., needed for all the route aircraft. So although we didn't have any Britannia aircraft at Changi, we had an engine and a propeller, or two or three engines and propellers for the Britannia. We had the overhaul for all the Griffin engines from the Shackletons. We had engines for things like the dart for the Andover, and we kept all the engines that were needed for aircraft that would fly that route, Tyne for the Belfast, and so on. And
so this is a storage as well as repair and maintenance. Then,
well, we were storing these serviceable engines, and then we were maintaining the engines that were used in the Hercules and particularly the Shackleton. Yeah. And I had a team that that did nothing else. There was Chinese amongst them and Indians that were refurbishing the Griffins for the Shackleton. I had a team that worked for the Allison for the Hercules.
Yes.
And then I had a prop bay man, a plug bay man. I had a lady that, sergeant, that did the dart engines. And then all the others were cocooned in when you receive an engine, it's in a blue sort of plastic bag with a lot of desiccant in it so that it's kept dry and can't corrode. And periodically you've got to open these and check that the desiccant is still all right and so on. But it was interesting work, and whenever you got a visiting aircraft that had a problem, we might have to give it a prop, or it might be an aircraft in Australia that needed an engine, and we had to get it down to Australia and so on. It was interesting. I wasn't the boss, I was the sort of foreman of the shop, with an elderly flight sergeant in charge. But sadly, just before he was due to be replaced, we went on a happy hour, which was always Friday night, 4 o'clock, go to the bar, half price, go home about 7:30, upset the wife, you see. So we went to a happy hour, and sadly he stepped into a monsoon drain, which was about 6 inches deep. Around each of the sort of blocks, there's an ordinary path about 2'6" wide, but because the windows have shutters on, and when the shutters are open, you can't really walk down the path, you have to step round the open shutter. And at the edge of the path is this narrow, it's probably 9 inches wide by about 5 inches deep, channel for channeling the water away. And he stepped to avoid the shutter and went over on his ankle and broke his ankle. And he was in his early 50s, and they, from the hospital, they casavacked him home because they said it won't heal at a man of your age out here. And so I was left in charge until they could find and give a man his leave to replace the one that had been injured. And it was quite enjoyable for my last few months to be
in charge.
The kingpin. Yeah. Mm.
It sounds like with this job you're moving away from actual maintenance and repair, more towards administration, towards management of others who are doing the maintenance.
Yes, this engine bay job was strictly keeping,
it's supervision rather than...
Not even so much supervision, making sure that they hit their targets.
Yes.
But there were always sergeants or chief techs that were there to do the oversigning.
Mm.
I wanted it when it was ready and so on. But as you can imagine, every Monday morning I'd go to the hangar and there'd be 8 Shackleton engines covered in oil, all with a little label tied to them saying "remove from." Now somebody has got to keep track of these.
Yes.
Because when you take an engine out, it might have done 610 hours, so you've got to make sure that you know what it's done. And when it's reissued again, it starts its life from 610 hours, and you've got to record all the modifications that have been done, all the work, and the job cards and so on. But more importantly, every aircraft has an inventory. And when an engine is removed, it's got to be taken off the inventory, and the replacement engine, which went straight in, has got to be put on the inventory. And because these aircraft inventories are usually held by junior officers, pilots and goodness knows who, they never do any of the paperwork. And so the supply branch are going wild because they've got an aircraft there that's got 18 engines. And it's only got four. And what they've never done is taken the old ones off. They've just added the new ones that they put in. And to keep a track on where engines were, because they're being returned to Rolls-Royce, they're being returned to East Kilbride, they're going into aircraft, they're being sent to Australia. This is a real major problem. And so one of my jobs was to make sure that this was kept track of and that the equipment section knew about it.
So you're keeping the records up to date as far as you could?
Yeah.
Now, you said you got Chinese and Indians working for you. How did you get on with them? Did you treat them the same way as you would British servicemen?
Yes. Most of them had been there for years.
Yes.
They'd been doing the same job.
Were they civilians?
Yes, they were civilians. Mm. But they were, a lot of them are camp followers. They'll go wherever the services are.
Yes.
The Rimi and everybody else had civilian sort of workers, but some of them achieve a skill level. They tend to be all right so long as there's nothing unusual occurs. If you show a Chinaman how to remove a cylinder block from a Griffin, renew all the seals and so on, and put it back again, he'll never forget that. But if he was to remove it and find that there was no piston on one of the cylinders, then he gets a bit flummoxed. But these people have been doing these jobs, very repetitive jobs, and it's like at a car plant. You see a chap slide a windscreen in or something, and he can do it in about 10 minutes, whereas it would take the average man 2 or 3 hours. And so they do become skilled at certain jobs. And some of the Indians, all they did was unpack engines and pack them. And some of the engines that they packed that were clapped or out of hours looked better than the ones they were receiving from Rolls-Royce that were the new ones. So that shows you how it's done, you know. And they knew threading all the plug leads and things. And these engines looked better, as I say, when we got rid of them than when they arrived. But that's the way it worked.
Did you find that they had different sort of temperaments, the Chinese and the Indians?
Oh, yes. Yeah, most certainly. The Indians, some of them tended to have very short fuses. Others, some of the Chinese were very affable. I had one that was probably the best man we had, and I couldn't understand a word he said. You know, he spoke very poor English. But you indicated what you wanted, and he knew exactly what to do.
He could understand you, although you couldn't understand him. Yeah,
that's right.
One-way traffic.
Mm. Yeah, but it, as I say, it was ever-varying. There was always something different happening. And still you got the problems with spares and stuff. I mean, at the time, they scrapped all the Griffins that had been in the old Mark II Shackleton. And we had the later marks, and this caused problems because all your spares have got to be changed over, or those that are compatible to both have got to be retained. So there was always something to keep you busy.
Were there any significant events that occurred while you were there, or was it more or less...
No, I don't know. No wars or anything to speak of. It was very much the end of Singapore and handing over to the Singapore Air Force. We had Chinese that were inducted into the Air Force sort of as auxiliaries to us.
Would this be the Singapore Air Force?
Yes, yeah. I mean, the Singapore Air Force took over Salita. Now, to be honest, the grass-cutting bill at Salita... we're talking about a very, very large area of land. And to keep the grass and the gardens, frangipanis and so on, I mean, all the quarters had Indian gardeners keeping the palms and things done. And the bill for just keeping the grass cut was more than the Singapore Air Force was given for a year to run itself, you know. So there was obviously going to be problems.